We're trying to figure out workarounds to get streaming going, at least in the interim until we can get things rolling. So, but it is time for us to go ahead and get started with our class. So why don't we start with a prayer together this morning? If you'll bow with me. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for this time that we have to be here together. Help us as we open your word together to look to it, to understand the truths that we can find to help us to live our lives to the praise of your glory. We thank you that Paul wrote this letter to the Corinthians. Help us to make the proper applications of what's given, and help us to be humble enough to make the necessary changes. We thank you for your word, for the one that all of it points to, your Son. Help us to be like him. We thank you for Jesus, and it's in his name we pray. Amen. All right, very good. We are in 1 Corinthians, I think, chapters 9 and 10. Does that sound legitimate? That's what I'm hoping is the case. Ben, can you do me a favor? Hold on, let me see. In my office, go into my office in my desk as you're facing my monitor. In the bottom left drawer, there's cough drops. Can you grab a couple for me, please? Thank you, sir. All right. So we are in 1 Corinthians, chapters 9 and 10. I keep saying 8 because 8, 9, and 10 is a single section together. Let's just make sure that we are getting ourselves a nice, good running start into, a nice, good running start into how this section is operating. Now, when you see the words "now concerning" in 1 Corinthians, what is that an indication of? Okay, we're dealing with something that they have asked Paul. Remember, there's the different sections. There are the things that Paul had learned from whom? Chloe's people. And then there are the things that they sent in a letter. And so he's interspersing this information throughout. And so chapters 8, 9, and 10 are sectioned together dealing with food offered to idols. Now, as we're doing this, do we have their letter that they sent to him? No, right? So we have to kind of pick apart his answer, and by looking at the answer, what are we trying to determine? All right, what was the question? What did they ask him? What did they say to him? The only way we can figure that out is by looking at the way that he responds. And so he says, now concerning food that's been offered to idols. Say, okay, well, apparently there was some question concerning eating food that has been offered to idols in some way, shape, or form. And as you go through the entire section, you kind of get the idea of what he's talking about, particularly in chapter 10. Let's see here. You know, we're going to skip ahead to chapter 10 just very, very quickly just to see what type of scenarios under discussion. Chapter 10, verse 27, if one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you are disposed to go, eat whatever's set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, oh, by the way, this has been offered in sacrifice, then do not eat it. For the sake of the one who informed you, for the sake of conscience. So what type of scenario is under discussion that prompts chapters 8, 9, and 10? Yeah, but you're too general. Paul is being more specific in this instance. Because he's trying to get them, you know, to see a particular type of scenario. I mean, don't get me wrong, Dick's absolutely right. It's about eating meat that's been sacrificed to idols, but in what way? Just in a generic, general, whatever? What's he talking about? Go ahead, Kathy. Oh, we're not that far yet. We're still setting up the scenario as it is right now. I mean, what did we just read in chapter 10? What's that picture that he just painted in chapter 10? Alright, you go to somebody's house, they set down food before you, and they say, hey, this meal has been offered to idols. That's what's under discussion. Can a Christian go into somebody's home and eat food that has been offered to idols? It seems as if the assumption is made that a Christian is not necessarily just in and of himself going to engage in the idolatrous practices, right? Is that a safe assumption? That a Christian's not going to go to the Greek temple and give food and then receive it back in order to eat it and partake in the system. Is that fair? A Christian's not going to do that. So that's not what's under discussion. What's under discussion is, can a Christian conscientiously eat meat if he knows that it has been sacrificed to idols? But even beyond that, it's even more than that. Can he do it if the one who's given it to him believes that this has been sacrificed to idols? Does that make sense? The question is not necessarily, can a Christian just simply eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols? It's, can a Christian accept meat from somebody else, and that person has announced that this food has been sacrificed to idols? What's the difference? Come on, you guys got an extra hour of sleep last night. You should be just raring to run at this. Yeah. Okay, so Richard's getting to the principle of not doing anything that you know is going to harm a person's conscience. And that's what Kathy was saying earlier. We'll get to that portion of the discussion. But what's the difference between asking, can a person eat a meat that they know has been sacrificed to idols, compared to, can a Christian eat a meat given to him by someone who announces this has been sacrificed to idols? What's the difference there, Beth? I don't think there's any way for us to say what a host would or wouldn't do necessarily in that scenario. Yeah. Okay, and that's fair. I mean, the way that I see it, I would think in a general scenario, the host would say, by the way, this has been offered to the great Athena, and, this is in honor of her. But that's fine. I mean, it's not going to be a hill I would die on there. Go ahead, Kelly. Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that's a principle we're going to. And to go to Bev's point, I'm not at all taking away from the fact that it's more than just the host that's in view right here. If there's if anybody, yes, were to say, by the way, you realize that that meat's been sacrificed to idols, but it very specifies, you're going to an unbeliever's house, and the unbeliever sets food, and let's just, for the sake of it, somebody announces that this food has been offered to idols. That's a different scenario than you just simply sitting at home saying, oh, well, this meat must have been offered to idols or something like that. And this goes to what Kelly's saying. It's less about the meat. It's more about the scenario. It's more about the situation. It's more about who else is involved besides just you, and how are your actions going to affect the other people who are involved. Does that make sense? So, looking further in, this is not, I mean, it starts off, yes, in chapter 8, now concerning meats that have been sacrificed to idols. But I think we can see that that statement reflects a deeper scenario that's under discussion. And if there's one thing that we can take from going through 1 Corinthians every time that we see the "and now" concernings throughout, and we kind of put it with the other sections as well, the people who wrote the letter, does Paul see them in a really good light? No. He doesn't. These, I think, are kind of the people that are the ones who he's going to have to deal with in 2 Corinthians chapters 9, at least 9 or 10 through the rest of the letter. You remember in 2 Corinthians where he writes the letter, and then it takes a very abrupt change at the end as he begins to address a different section of the church, and that's the leadership who opposes him, opposes his apostleship, opposes all of that. These are those individuals. They're the ones who write a letter to Paul, and they say, oh, by the way, Paul, can you help us with this meat sacrifice to idols? And can you help us to determine what's the most important spiritual gift? And, we'd really like to take up a collection and send it to those needy people in Jerusalem. And there's all of these nice, quaint little things. When what are the biggest issues that are going on in Corinth? Are those things that they wrote and asked about? No. There's a lot of really messed up stuff going on at Corinth, and they write their letter to Paul, and they kind of mention these light, types of things, or, hey, Paul, we want a better understanding, or this or that. When there's divisions that are taking place, to the point, did y'all talk about chapter 11 already? I know that some points. But the way that they're totally making a mockery of the Lord's Supper, the way that they divide themselves according to the divisions in chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4, I really appreciate. I know Kevin spent a lot of time on chapters 1 through 4 in order to hammer in the divisions that are taking place, because that's a problem that permeates all the way through 1 Corinthians. That's the main issue, and everything kind of follows through. So when Paul responds to their questions, he's going to use the opportunities to kind of drive some comments in. And he's not always going to be perfectly nice in the way that he responds to a lot of things. So in chapter 8, he says, look, verse 4, therefore, as to eating a food offered to idols, we know an idol has no real existence. There is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Now the "we know that's" and "of course that's" that you see there, those are probably quotations from the letter. Paul is probably taking their words and then saying, now, of course, yes, you are right that there is no God, other gods, that these things are not gods, and all of this. As in, they are saying to Paul, hey, Paul, we've got a problem here. This is how I interpret the question. And we don't have time to go into all the ins and outs, but this is what I think they asked Paul. Paul, we've got a problem here where there's this group of Christians here who won't eat meats that have been sacrificed to idols. And it's really bumming us out. This is a problem because we can't just get meats and we'll be in the middle of eating and they'll, you know, we'll look over, they're not eating. And, you know, this is really an issue, Paul. Can you tell these morons over here that it's okay to eat this meat? That if it's been offered to an idol, there is no real God there. There's nothing wrong with it. Come on, Paul. Just get up and tell these folks to get in line. And Paul writes back and says, yeah, you're right. There is no real God there. There's nothing behind this. You are absolutely right. You can eat that meat and have no issues doing it. However, verse 7, does everyone possess this knowledge? Consider those who were really, truly engrossed in this idol system, their former association with idols. And they eat food as readily offered to an idol, their conscience being weak is then defiled. Will food condemn us or commend us to God? No, we're not worse off if we do not eat. We're not better if we eat it. However, take care to make sure that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. And some of y'all have already mentioned this. This is what this whole section, chapters 8, 9, and 10, this is what it's about. He just said it in one phrase, the thesis statement, make sure this right, this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. By the way, who's the weak? What does that mean, the weak? Does that mean someone who just, he's not very strong in the faith, he's a new babe, you know, he just doesn't, he doesn't have a strong faith yet? Is that what it means? All right, Julia just said, those who don't have the same understanding. He's just saying, not weak in general, as in a weak Christian. He's saying that in this issue, someone who does not properly understand his liberty. That's the weak one. Someone who just does not properly understand his liberty. That's all that this is addressing. And weak will change, strong and weak will change from issue to issue to issue. He's not saying the Christian himself is weak, but his understanding in this issue is weak. He doesn't understand the full liberties that he possesses. Therefore, if, verse 10, anyone sees you who have knowledge eating, that is, you understand, you grasp, you get your liberties, and so you eat. And if anyone sees you who does not have who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. Now here, he goes to the far extreme in his illustration, right? You know, he's using illustrations to make the point. What's the far extreme that he uses right here? If someone sees you doing what? Right, eating in the idol's temple itself. You know, if you go into the temple and may, you know, this is kind of an indication. In fact, I think that they have found, and I don't know, Dave may be really good to ask about this. He's just spent some time in idols' temples. Can't believe you, Dave, going. You probably ate there too, didn't you? Now, you know, they probably had some type of dining areas that they had with the sacrifices and things such as that. Again, though, principally speaking, I don't think a Christian would have done that. I don't think Paul thinks a Christian would have done that. he's using. This is an extreme example that he gives. He says, what if they saw you eating in the idol's temple? Therefore, you know, there's no doubt, 100%, there's no way around it. You are eating meat that was part of the sacrificial, idolatrous sacrificial system. What would they assume? What would they think? And if, let's see, verse 11, if by your knowledge this weak person, so that by your knowledge this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died, thus sinning against your brothers, wounding their conscience when it is weak, and you sin against Christ. How does that happen? Did y'all talk about this a couple weeks ago or whenever? In what way can you cause the downfall of your brother here? Mary Martha?
Mm-hmm.
No, I do not. And again, like I said, Dave and Sharon just spent some time over there, looking through and talking a lot about this. It wasn't even their first time over there. Maybe some other folks have been over there going through these same types of tours that might be able to speak better to it. Other than to say that there was a ritual to it. There was the pomp and circumstance that surrounded the sacrifices that were offered to these idols. If you have these various places, and remember, Corinth is not too far away from Athens. You're right in the middle of all this Greek idolatrous type stuff going on. So there would have been a lot of this. But his whole point, and Mary Martha got to this, and I appreciated that, is when somebody sees you doing this thing, it's going to affect them and their own conscience. So we're quickly running out of time. I haven't gotten to chapter 9 yet. So we get into chapter 9. Remember what this is about. This is a discussion about liberties, what you are or are not allowed to do, who understands those liberties of what you are or are not allowed to do, the strong and the weak, and then how to handle the difference. So we get into chapter 9, and Paul begins changing subjects completely, right? We're in a brand new section now in chapter 9, because now Paul starts talking about whether he's allowed to receive money and whether he's allowed to get married. So now that we've totally changed subjects from one to the other, let's talk about this. Have we really changed subjects? Is this a new section? No, right? It's the same thing. What's his point when he starts talking about, in chapter 9, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my workmanship in the Lord? And if to others I'm not an apostle, at least I know I'm an apostle to you. You're the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. So just a reminder to them of their relationship with him. He brought the gospel there as an apostle of Jesus. Verse 3, this is my defense to those who would examine me, challenge me. Do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we not have the right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles and the brothers of our Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard without eating any of its fruit? Who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? All right, let's talk about this, because what is under discussion in this section right here? I mean, he talks about getting married and all of that, but what does he really move towards? Lorraine? Yeah, but Yeah, he's talking about his liberties, his freedoms, but he's moving towards a very specific one. Which one does he kind of leads them into, and then what is the very specific one that he ends with? Not a trick question. What's the last one that he says there? Okay. Well, the right to receive payment for what he's doing, right? Isn't that the last one that he really gets into? He spends more time with that. Is verse 6, is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? That is, to receive our living from the working that we're doing. I mean, who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard without eating any of its fruit? Who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? Why is that one important to our discussion with the Corinthians? What do you know of Paul's time in Corinth? In fact, it's specifically Corinth that gives us this tidbit of information about Paul. And working. And money. From Acts. Did someone say tense? I hope someone said tense. What did Paul do? Okay, from over here? Yeah, I see. All right, what did Paul do in Corinth itself? He made tents until who showed up? All right, so why did he stop when Timothy and Silas showed up? Well, more than that, because they brought money with them. You know, that's what he tells the Philippians in chapter 4. Even in the very beginning, you were the first ones to take concern for me and send money along with them. I mean, he worked building tents. Silas and Timothy show up, and they are apparently bringing money from up in Macedonia. And he says, all right, now I don't have to keep on working here. I can continue to devote myself to the preaching of the gospel. That indicates that Paul, how much money do you think Paul took from the Corinthians? Zero. He didn't take anything from them. And he explains that to the churches in Ephesus in Acts chapter 20, right? I'm sorry, to the elders in Ephesus. How he refused that right, that liberty to do so wherever he went. He made tents. Instead of saying to the Corinthians, you know what, guys? A laborer is worthy of his wages, right? Would you all mind kind of, I don't know, just helping me out so I get at least one meal a day? Or anything like that? He didn't even cross his mind. He made tents to take care of it. And that actually, we know from 2 Corinthians, that actually became something that people said, well, he obviously isn't a real apostle. If he was, he would have known that he was worthy to have received gifts from us and money from us. But he obviously doesn't see himself on that kind of a level because he wouldn't even accept our gifts. You know, that seems to be, reading 2 Corinthians, what one of their claims was against him. And so he's explaining it here. He's saying, yeah, I had every right to do that. Everybody does. A soldier doesn't go out and just work for nothing. Someone who tends the flock gets some of the milk. You know, he's saying, I had every right to take money from you while I was there with you for the, you know, around 2 years or so that he spent with them. Now, you know, he keeps on going with this whole thing. Do I say these things on human authority? Does the law say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not certainly speak for our sake? It was written for our sake because the plowman should plow in hope, the thresher thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. If we have sown spiritual things among you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If others share this rightful claim on you, do we not even more? So, he's saying right here, I had every right, every liberty to come to you and expect that you would provide me with monetary assistance. Nevertheless, middle of verse 12, nevertheless, we did not make use of this right. We endure anything rather than to put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service, they get their food from the temple? Those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offerings. In the same way, the Lord commanded those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. Verse 15, but I have made no use of any of those rights, those liberties, those things that belong to me. And then he says, and I'm not even writing this to try to get you to compensate. He's like, it's not that I'm, you know, don't get me wrong. This is Paul's way of saying, don't hear what I'm not saying, right? He's like, I'm not asking for you to make up for it and send me provision. I would rather die than have someone deprive me of my ground here for boasting. For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting, for necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward, but if not of my own will, I'm still entrusted with a stewardship. What then is my reward? That in my preaching I may present the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel. All right. Can you follow? We don't have a ton of time to talk about all of this, but can you follow his reasoning through here? He says, I have every right to accept monetary sustenance from the church wherever I am, whatever city I am, so that they can pay me in order to continue the work that I am doing. Right? I mean, that's the way that Paul lays this out. And by the way, that extends for anybody who is doing the work of the gospel in whatever facility that they're doing, whether it be me as an evangelist, whether it be elders who are serving in their respective places, as, you know, Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 5, those who are laboring and serving in these various capacities, they have the right. And sometimes it's necessary to, take that right. But for Paul, this was a real issue for him, I think very personally, that the way he looked at it, if he got paid for this, then what? If Paul went into Corinth and said, hey, I'm going to teach you the gospel, here's my fee, then what? Yeah, he's just peddling wares at that point, right? That's all that he's doing. He's selling something to them. And he's like, that's not the gospel. Yeah, Jan? Yeah, you know, Jan talked about the I'm of Paul, I'm Apollos, but very specifically the I planted, Apollos watered, God granted the increase, right? That concept, you know, it's not about Paul, it's not about Apollos, it's about God and the glory of God through the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he doesn't want anything to get in the way of that. He doesn't want anyone to step in. It's kind of like I had this conversation with John a few weeks ago when, remember in Genesis 14 when Kedorlaomer came in and took Lot and a bunch of other nations and then went off and then Abraham ran them down, defeated them, and brought the people back? And the king, do you remember which king it was, John? Anyway, one of the kings came to him and said, it was one of the kings, you know, who said, look, thank you. I really appreciate it. You know, I'll just take my people and we'll go back, but you can keep all the spoils because you deserve it. You've earned it. You won. You defeated them. And Abraham's like, no, you take all of it. I don't want anybody to be able to tell me you're rich because of me. I'm rich because of God. That's it. Glory to God, nobody else. That's kind of, I think, the same idea that's going on right here with Paul. He says, you know, verse 15, I made no use of any of these rights. And that's really important. So, again, we're running out of time. Verse 19, though I am free from all, I made myself a servant to all, so that I might win more of them. To the Jews, I became as a Jew, in order to win Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though, I mean, not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I've become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it for the sake of the gospel, that I might share with them in its blessing. All right, so you probably have heard this section before. Is that fair? You know, to the weak, I became weak. So to the Jews, I became as a Jew. You think that was difficult for Paul? No, he grew up as a Jew, right? I mean, that's who and what he is. He knows the ins and outs of what it means to be a Jew, probably more than most Jews do. And he says, I have no problem slipping into that mode. So that when I talk to Jews, I'm able to do so. Yeah, Kelly?
We're like, hey, people have been saying you've been teaching not to do Jewish things, so why don't you just do this to prove them wrong?
Yeah, yeah. Kelly's referencing in Acts chapter 21 when Paul is on his way, after his third journey, he's on his way to Jerusalem with the money from, you know, the Galatian churches, the Macedonian churches, Corinth, all of those. They're on their way back. And they get into town, and James is like, you know, Paul, we've got a problem here. People are saying that you're going everywhere telling the Jews to just totally throw away the law of Moses. What are we going to do about it? And James says, I've got this proposition. There's some folks who are going to finish their purifications. They got sacrifices. Why don't you go with them? Pay for them. Take care of those and join in with it so that you can show everyone that you haven't just thrown the law off as if it's nothing. Yeah, so absolutely. Paul still very much holds that part of him. Remember, what did he do with Timothy when he picked Timothy up? Had him circumcised. But I thought Paul said over and over and over and over and over and over again through his letters that circumcision means nothing. Why would he do that? That seems hypocritical, doesn't it?
Synagogues and teach.
All right. Does circumcision mean nothing to Timothy?
Yeah. It doesn't mean anything to Timothy.
Oh, it should. Because Timothy's a what? He's a Jew, right? So, he is circumcised so that he can participate in and be a part of the Jewish culture. So that when he gets into various cities, he can go into the synagogues and have joint participation as a Jew, cultically speaking. Now, that circumcision had absolutely nothing to do with his relationship with God. We understand that. But it was important for him to do it to have a relationship with the rest of his people because he couldn't have it. Now, does Paul want a Gentile to become circumcised?
No.
No. Because circumcision means nothing to the Gentiles. There is nothing to be gained by them. They're not Jews. They're not part of that specific covenant where circumcision's a part of it. Kelly?
Are we assuming, Becky was just telling me, are we assuming that Timothy's dad said no to circumcision?
Yes.
Is that why? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I have to go back and look at the specifics, but it's generally, you know, his dad probably was not a Jew.
Yeah.
And so it would have been a Greek, and yes, you know, would not have allowed it. All right, so all of this aside, Paul very clearly is pointing out that it's worth it to do what you need to do in order to have a good relationship with the people so that you can do what? Teach them what the gospel says. Is there a limit to that? Yes. Even when he says those without law, what does he mean, by the way, when he says those without law? What law? Yeah, the law of Moses, right? To those without law, he says, I become without law, but what? What does he then go on to say? He throws in the caveat. He says, well, obviously, I mean, I still abide within the law of Christ. That doesn't mean that he simply becomes lawless at that point. That doesn't mean that he says, well, these people are doing sinful things, so in order for me to blend in, I should do these sinful things with them. That's not at all what he's saying. But he says that I am able to join a group of Gentiles without having to become one of those pretentious Jews that looks down their nose at these Gentiles all the time. I can fit in with them as a Gentile. In order to bring them to Christ, it doesn't matter. He's not going to create problems where problems don't need to be created. But then verse 22, to the weak. Who are the weak? Exactly. To the ones who don't fully understand what their liberties are, and it changes from issue to issue to issue to issue, right? It changes, whatever it is. But he says, I understand my liberties. To the weak one in this discussion, even though I know exactly what my liberty is, I'm going to become weak on this. I'm going to be like, you know what, you're absolutely right. We should not eat this. Well, I'm getting that. That's where we're going. That's the payoff, right? You're absolutely right. We should not eat this meat that's been sacrificed to an idol because you have a problem with it. You don't understand your liberties, and it's not my job to fix your problem with your liberties. That's not my issue. My issue is to proclaim the gospel of Christ and to bring you to a better relationship with God. And if this is going to be what's going to detract us, distract us, and keep away from that, yeah, I'll never eat meat again. Yeah, I mean, and obviously there are parallels, by the way. It's not one-to-one parallel between 1 Corinthians and Romans 14. I think those are two separate issues as far as why they're not eating the meats. You know, one is a Jew-Gentile thing. This one's just a meat sacrifice to idols thing here. But it's the same principle of understanding your rights and your liberties. Verse 24, don't you know that all runners in a race run? Only one receives a prize. Run in a way that you will obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things to receive a perishable wreath. We an imperishable. So I don't run without aim. I don't box just swinging and hitting only air. Instead, I discipline my body. I keep it under control so that after preaching to others, I would not become disqualified. Now, keep this in context. It's very easy to just kind of say, well, let's talk about running a race and stuff like that and ignore the context of what's going on. What's he talking about right here? What disqualifies him? Eight, nine, and ten. What disqualifies him?
Disqualifies who?
Paul. Yeah, he says, lest I be disqualified.
He just acts on his own discipline for his own self.
Yeah, ignoring the needs of others and doing what he wants to do without controlling himself will disqualify him. That's very specifically what is under discussion. I'm sorry, I don't have time for I really wish I did. But we need to get into the payoff here. You know what? Go ahead, real quick. Go ahead, John.
No. Good.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, the whole thing, all of this is about understanding your rights, but not forcing your understanding of your rights and your liberties on other people who understand that differently. meat sacrifice to idols. By the way, we're skipping over a really cool section where he compares what they're doing with what the Israelites did in the wilderness, the testing narratives that we talked about before, with their grumbling, how they were destroyed, that they are there for us to look at and to see that it is possible to seem like everything's going great and then find yourself being led straight into destruction. But we really need to get to the payoff here in chapter 10. If you're there and you walk into someone's house, and as Bev said, whether it's the host or someone else who's sitting beside you and kind of puts their hand on your arm and says, you know, that meat's been sacrificed to an idol, right? Whatever the scenario, why does he say, if you know it's been sacrificed to an idol, don't eat it? Why does he say that?
Somebody told you.
Okay. That's somebody who told you what's going on in their mind.
They got their problem.
Okay, but what's their problem? Why do they care?
They're probably weak.
All right. The issue, though. What is the issue of meat sacrificed to idols? If you eat it, what's the assumption? Go ahead. That you are worshiping that idol by eating it. That's the assumption. That when you partake of and you eat the meat that's been offered to this idol, you are joining in that sacrificial system. And therefore you are being a part of that idolatrous worship. And somebody who understands their liberties will say, well, we know that there is no real idol. There's no God behind that idol. It's all just a big farce, so it doesn't matter anyway. So who cares? We can just eat it. But the one who says, hey, you realize that's been sacrificed to an idol, right? Or the host who says, everybody, we are joining in the proper worship of Athena this evening as we got these meats, you know, straight from the altar itself, and here they are. There is an assumption behind those statements that the person who made the comment believes that by eating this, they are participating in the idolatrous worship themselves. Are they really?
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Because their conscience makes it so. Their conscience makes it so. It is sinful for them to do that. Even though it's not sinful for you, it is sinful for them to do that. If that's what they believe about it. And when you try to persuade them otherwise, get them to go ahead, get them to do it, demonstrate by your example, and get them to eat that which they know is sinful to eat, you have destroyed your brother in the process. Is it worth it?
No.
For a steak? I mean, steaks can be really good sometimes. But you will never eat a steak that's that good. You'll never eat a piece of meat that's worth that. And that's why he says, verse 33, and so then, my brothers, when you come together... Oh, wait, hold on. I'm like, that doesn't sound right, because I skipped to chapter 10. All right, so, in chapter 11. So there in chapter 10, verse 31. So, whatever you eat or drink, whatever you do, do it to the glory of God. Give no offense to Jews, to Greeks, or to the church of God. Be above reproach, right? Just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of the many, that many may be saved. And then chapter 11, verse 1, goes with chapter 10. Be imitators of me, as I imitate Christ. It says, follow my example. It's a worthy example to follow, because I am following the example of Jesus himself. All right, that brings us to our time. Thanks a lot, guys. Good class. Hopefully, Kevin will be able to jump back in next week. Thanks a lot.